This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The Amazon lungs of the planet are baking with extended record heat. Wet rainforests are drying out. Rivers are the highways and lifeblood of the Amazon people. But now rivers shrunk to small streams of toxic water. This is a big, barely reported emergency. The very best reporting comes through the award-winning nonprofit media group Manga Bay. The founder and CEO is Rhett Butler. Rhett started out on his own, posting thousands of environmental articles and photos. Now Manga Bay has more than 90 staff across 5 bureaus and a network of about 1,000 correspondents. In 80 countries, it's big. Rhett Butler, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
According to Al Jazeera, 9 heat waves have hit Brazil since the beginning of 2023, with the heat index in Rio de Janeiro soaring to almost 60 degrees Celsius at one point, 140 degrees Fahrenheit in November. Talk to us about the extreme heat cooking the Amazon.
Yeah, so the Amazon is experiencing a similar trend. So it's a combination of both heat and drought. And so those two things together are pretty bad for the rainforest. There's been this big jump in fires. So you have the heat, which, you know, dries out the forest, and then you have lack of rainfall, which further exacerbates conditions. And so these fires that are traditionally set for land clearing will then burn into forests and have a very significant impact on the health of the forest. The types of fires that are burning are these sub-canopy fires, so they're not sort of like these giant forest fires you'd see in the U.S. They'll often just burn the leaf litter, but what that does is it actually will kill the forest in the long term, so it's a very detrimental impact. And then the lack of rainfall is also causing the rivers to run dry, so it's stranding communities, it's killing wildlife. There was a news story about a large number of dolphins basically getting baked to death in a lake in the Amazon from high temperatures. This is what it looks like in the Amazon. It's a very, very detrimental to the ecosystem and the people there.
Yeah, according to longtime Amazon watcher Philip Fearnside, the city of Manaus has the lowest water levels in 121 years of river records. And Amazonians are at a loss. Their food, fish are gone. Remaining river water makes anyone sick. And the stunning thing is, Brett, consumer economies far away in the north kind of helped do this. We burned the fossil fuels and stripped life until the overheat or drought arrives in the Amazon. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, none of this is a surprise. Researchers and their models have been forecasting this sort of scenario since the 1990s, really. And it's just been getting worse every cycle. So every few years, we see the same thing happen, and it just gets worse and worse. So really no surprises to the researchers who study these things.
Does the forest manage to recover in between these bouts?
I mean, so that's an interesting question. So in some places it can recover, but normally the trend is towards degradation. So especially if there is fire that burns, so the fire will greatly weaken the forest and typically lead to die-off. So generally the progressive trend across much of the Amazon is towards a drier ecosystem. And so the big fear is that large sections of the Amazon rainforest, especially in the south and the east, could tip towards this drier savanna-like ecosystem. And so once that happens, it has major implications for carbon storage, for rain, you know, precipitation patterns across the South American continent. And so that's kind of the great fear. So recovery is possible, but that's not the trend we're seeing. We're seeing the situation get worse and worse.
Well, there is some good news. A post January 8th at Yale 360 says forest loss in the Brazilian Amazon was down 50% year on year in 2023, according to government figures. Why is that, and is it enough to counterbalance these climate-driven changes?
It is a very positive sign. So the official numbers showed a 22% decline in 2023 versus 2022. The alert-based data is showing a larger decline for the full 2023 year. We'll know in a few months what the extent of that is, but you know, it looks very positive. This is largely the consequence of a new political regime in Brazil. So the previous president was Jair Bolsonaro, who was I would say most environmentalists and scientists would say that he was no friend of the forest, so his greatly reduced protections for the Amazon, reduced law enforcement, one could argue encouraged deforestation. So he lost the election last year and was replaced by Lula, who in his first two terms as president oversaw this huge reduction in deforestation in the mid-2000s to the early 2020s, to early 10s. And so he came in, part of his campaign was that he was going to, you know, protect the Amazon and stop this rise in deforestation. And so once he entered office in January 2023, he immediately started to reinstate those programs to reduce deforestation and enforce environmental laws and rally international support for protecting the Amazon. And so if you look at the month-to-month deforestation, there was this huge drop right after he came into office, and it just continued. So there's pretty good evidence to suggest that this political change has had this major implications for the rate of deforestation in the Amazon. That said, it's not nearly enough to sort of reverse these longer-term trends. We'd need to see a much greater reduction in deforestation over a longer period of time to, I think, feel really optimistic about what's happening. Because the rate of change and the scale of change that's happening across the Amazon basin from the drying trends are pretty negative. So we're going to have to both reduce deforestation, but also address the broader issue of climate change to ensure that there's an Amazon, you know, 20, 30 years in the future that we still recognize.
We have rainforests in British Columbia along the coast that haven't burned for over 1,000 years because they're so wet. Why are there major fires in the formerly wet Brazilian and Ecuadorian and the whole Amazon rainforest?
Well, so there's a couple things going on. So one is there's a lot of forest degradation. If you have an intact rainforest, you know, that's large in extent, those interior areas are pretty protected from fire. But if you cut those forest blocks into smaller fragments, you have more points of entry for both deforestation, but also things like wind. And the wind will cause more tree falls. And so the more trees falls you have, the more disturbance you have. And so that could dry out what's normally a very humid environment. And so if you couple that with drought, so lack of rainfall, and then the fires that are being set for land clearing, you get conditions that can lead to fires spreading into these normally wet forests that would not burn. And so that's exactly what's happened, especially in the Brazilian Amazon, is these small agricultural fires will then burn into these forest areas, and because the leaf litter is dry, they will burn vast areas that you may not be obvious if you're looking at a satellite or a satellite imagery or something like that, but it's having these real effects on the ecosystem. And so once that forest litter burns, there's a much higher likelihood of that forest dying off in the future. A lot of these, you know, rainforest trees are not adapted to be able to survive fire. So they may survive for a few years, but they're basically compromised. And so, again, the likelihood of them falling down in the future is much higher than if they had not been affected by the fire.
Well, the European Joint Research Center published a study in December titled Drought in the Amazon Basin, November 2023. They also point to El Nino as a driver of warmer and drier times there. Brett, how do you balance El Nino and climate change in this Amazon emergency?
Well, I mean, El Nino is definitely a factor as well. And so you tend to see pretty bad droughts in El Nino years in the Amazon. And so that's what we had this past year. El Nino is a cyclical thing that affects the Amazon, but then you have kind of this baseline of climate change, which is generally rising temperatures and exacerbating the drought and kind of flood cycle. And so when you combine those two things, the trend is negative, but it's greatly exacerbated in those El Nino years. They're both related and very concerning, but anytime you have an El Nino, you worry about fires in the Amazon and then fires in Indonesia.
So do you think the current extremes in the Amazon are a one-off with El Nino, or is this an almost unlivable normal developing as the years go by?
Well, the trend is definitely drying, so it's not a one-off. It tends to be worst in the arc of deforestation, so the southern Amazon and the eastern Amazon. So those are, you know, naturally the drier parts of the Amazon, but they're they're suffering the effects of El Niños and climate change much more than the Western Amazon. So those are the regions that scientists are really concerned about tipping towards a drier ecosystem. And so there's already quite a bit of evidence of these kind of dry forest transition trees species that are appearing in these forests now. So there's this community is already shifting. So that is a concerning trend if you're worried about the rainforest ecosystem transitioning towards a different, drier type of ecosystem.
Also, Amazing Amazon News, a paper in Science titled Discovered in the Upper Amazon, 2,500-year-old landscape providing evidence for early urbanism in the region. They found 6,000 platforms and plaza structures connected by footpaths, straight roads, and extensive agriculture. All this in the Ecuadorian Amazon, starting at the time of Homer and the ancient Greeks. Isn't that exciting? But we don't even know what we're losing, really, as we lose it.
Yeah, I mean, so certainly. So there's been, I would say in the last 20 years, maybe even 15 years, there's been a lot of these discoveries around these metropolises that existed in the Amazon, you know, pre-Columbian. And so there's, you know, the Amazon diversity is partly a product of, you know, these societies that were in the region. And so, especially along major rivers, there were very substantial settlements and amazing cultures that were built around this ecosystem. And so once there was the massive die-off following European arrival from the diseases that are introduced, the forest reclaimed those areas. And it's not like other parts of the world where, you know, it's preserved by a desert environment. You have the forest comes back and kind of reclaims those lands. So it's taken a while to make these discoveries. They've always been there kind of in folklore, but with new technologies like LIDAR and, I mean, especially LIDAR, you're able to sense these things at scale and really understand what was once there. So there are certainly still a lot of, you know, new discoveries being made in the Amazon, and we really don't know what we're losing, both in terms of culture, but also in terms of the biological diversity and all the things that could benefit humanity out of that biological diversity.
Yeah, a lot of new drugs have been discovered from those kind of rainforests, and yet we barely managed to catalog what's there.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. Alex Smith here with Rhett Butler, founder and CEO of award-winning media outlet Manga Bay. There are some solutions. What can governments and citizens do to save what is left of the great Amazon rainforest?
One of the most basic things is, you know, protecting the forest. And so, you know, traditionally people think of that as being, you know, national parks or reserves established by governments, but there's a growing body of research that shows that lands that are managed by indigenous people, so like in the Amazon, these would be indigenous territories, often have better outcomes in terms of forest cover and preservation of biodiversity than even national parks. And so anything that can be done to sort of support indigenous peoples, the recognition of indigenous peoples' land rights in the context of the Amazon and other ecosystems can be very positive for protecting the forest. So that's one of the big things that is at the top of the list. Another is thinking about, you know, your own personal consumption and how living your daily life affects the Amazon. So there are certain products you buy that may be sourced from the Amazon, and, you know, whether it's beef or soy, things like that. And it can be really powerful for consumers to convey their concern about the products they buy from the companies that produce these products. So if you call these companies or write to them and ask, you know, how are you sourcing your soy? If you see that, you know, a company's product is coming from Brazil, if enough people do that, it can send a very powerful signal to these companies that, oh, our consumers are asking these questions, and, you know, we need to think about how we're sourcing these commodities. So that's another thing. And of course, supporting organizations that are working in the Amazon, you know, helping strengthen indigenous rights, helping set up protected areas. So that's another, you know, vector for having impact in the region.
Well, tell us about Manga Bay publishing a new edition of the book, A Perfect Storm in the Amazon. What's there, and is it free?
Yeah, so this is a work by Tim Killeen, who's a longtime Amazon expert. He's been working in the region for 30 or 40 years. And so he published this book called The Perfect Storm in the Amazon, which is looking at the Amazon from a little bit different context than I think environmentalists or conservationists typically look at the region. So he's looking at sort of like the economic drivers of what's contributing to change in the Amazon, whether it's conservation or driving deforestation, you know, and these higher level trends. And so he, in a very comprehensive way, is talking about all the things that affect the Amazon and, you know, what it means for the ecosystem. And so we are publishing his book, three languages, for free across the Spanish, Portuguese, and English on our website over the next 3 years. So you can actually download the full book for free, a digital version. The content that's being published on the website is an updated version. So, you know, that's one of the benefits, I guess, of the website version. But, you know, if you wanted to read the book ahead of time, the original version of it, then you can download it for free from the website. But, yeah, so this is a series that's going to run for the next 2 years, since we've already done 1 year. And the reception to it has been very positive. I think for a lot of Manga Bay readers who work in conservation or, you know, are activists, it's bringing some new information that they haven't traditionally thought about when they do their work in the context of the Amazon.
Well, another great rainforest and biological hotspot at risk is in Indonesia. Did you live there for a while, Brett?
No, I've never lived in Indonesia, but I've done a lot of reporting on Indonesia over the years. And Manga Bay's first non-English bureau was in Indonesia because I saw it as being a really critical place for protecting biodiversity and, you know, these critical habitats. And so the reason I started Manga Bay as a nonprofit was to launch this Indonesian language news service.
So Manga Bay just published a story about the increase in deforestation in Indonesia by the pulp and paper industry, despite big producers like April and APP committing to zero deforestation. If this continues to escalate, what is at stake, and are the Indonesian government or companies likely to do anything to reverse this trend?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a lot of nuance here. So actually, Indonesia, the deforestation rate in Indonesia has fallen very dramatically since 2015, 2016. So the trend is the kind of the macro trend is very positive. Whether it will continue, you know, is a bit uncertain. For one thing, there hasn't been a strong El Nino. There hadn't been a strong El Nino since 2015, 2016 in the region, and there tends to be this correlation between deforestation, forest loss, and El Nino events. So this year was kind of the first test as to whether, you know, it's actually policy change or it's just sort of like the luck of the weather that was influencing this deforestation rate. And so far it looks like the deforestation rate will be relatively low for 2023 compared to last year. So that's a very positive trend. That said, the pulp and paper industry, you know, in the early 2010s, they made all these commitments to eliminate deforestation from the supply chain. Their deforestation has been creeping back up. And those companies, and some of those big players, specifically APP, which is H. Bolton Paper, April, have broken their commitments. APP shifted their baselines, allowing more deforestation in the supply chain. So if we look specifically at that sector, deforestation for pulp and paper has increased. So overall deforestation decreasing in Indonesia, but the deforestation related to pulp and paper has been increasing. If we're looking out, though, in the future, there are some things to be concerned about in Indonesia. So there's this push to build up a food estate. I mean, that's the language that's used. I mean, basically converting large areas of forest for industrial agriculture. This has been done before. It did not work well, but it's been resurrected. So that's something that's happening. Another is these biofuel mandates within Indonesia. So it's basically creating a large source of demand for palm oil. So, you know, it may not result in deforestation, but it could, you know, it is something to watch. So, you know, the recent trend has been positive, but there are some things to be concerned about. Indonesia is also having an election this year, and the leading candidate has been sort of an outspoken critic of environmental policy and protection. So, again, some things to be wary of in Indonesia, but we should be pleased with the progress, at least of the past few years in general.
Well, in the El Nino of 1997-98, Indonesia became one of the world's biggest greenhouse gas emitters due to fires on the peat bogs that they dried out for plantations. I wonder what those companies should be doing to mitigate that fire risk and reduce their contribution to global climate change, which affects all of us.
Yeah, I mean, the answers are, people know what to do. The question is, will they do it? So really, you need to reflood some of those areas. These peatlands are bogs, and so, you know, the water table is, you know, essentially near the surface. And so what they do is they reduce the water table, so they build drainage ditches to drop the water level so then they can do their acacia plantations. The problem is that dried peat is very flammable, and so if there's an ignition source and you can have these fires that, you know, burn out of control for, I mean, in some cases, decades, releasing huge amounts of carbon and then, you know, degrading the entire ecosystem and also causing air pollution at the same time. So it's pretty clear, you know, what you need to do to sort of mitigate the situation, but it just really depends on the company's commitments to, you know, actually taking action and addressing the issue.
You are a powerhouse hub of information about the wild. You co-founded the journal Tropical Conservation Science. In 2023, you co-authored a paper there, broadening the focus of forest conservation beyond carbon. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that was a review of some of the high-level trends that are happening in tropical forests. So in the past, I mean, 10 to 15 years has really been this emphasis on carbon for forests. And, you know, one of the challenges is if you reduce the value of a forest to just the carbon sequestered, you miss out on kind of the bigger picture. So some of the other ecosystem services, the biodiversity, things of that nature. And so this paper talks about some of those macro trends and kind of the implications for conservation. And then also some of the other things that need to be, you know, kind of brought back into the equation. So biodiversity and water. I mean, so I've long argued that the water services that are afforded by forests are really critical and are, you know, arguably harder to replace than, you know, carbon sequestration. So there's a component of that in this paper as well. So it's really a kind of an overview of these broad trends in the forest conservation space. And so one of those trends, which we already touched on this call, was this idea of broadening the constituency of who is involved with conservation. So, looking at the data around indigenous lands and seeing that those lands protect forests better than a lot of other, you know, types of management, so whether it's national parks or unprotected lands. And so that's been one of the key things that I would say has emerged over the past 5 to 10 years is recognition of just how critical it is to secure land rights for indigenous people so they can, you know, continue to manage these forest lands, which, you know, sequester carbon and protect biodiversity. So that's one of the major trends. Another one of the major trends is around technology. So the idea that we can see what's happening with forests better than ever, so we no longer have ignorance as an excuse for not taking action. Because we can see what's happening, even if there's cloud cover, we can use radar to penetrate the clouds and see, you know, when deforestation is happening. So that's been another major trend in this space. And when I talk about broadening the constituency, the idea around that is that forests as healthy and productive ecosystems provide all these values to humanity. So it's not just, you know, a habitat for tapir or jaguar. It's sequestering carbon. It's ensuring that there's rainfall in southern South America where huge amounts of agriculture is produced. When you have healthy forests, you have less forest fires, so at least in the context of the tropics. So, you know, there's health implications from that in terms of air quality. So all these things are important things that forests do for us, and as we get better science to explain how these systems work, we can tell the story of the importance of forests to different audiences and build a broader, you know, coalition of people who should care about forests because they directly affect their well-being personally.
What is next for you, Rhett Butler?
Well, I'm planning to keep working on Manga Bay for a while. We have a bunch of new initiatives we're launching this year. So we're expanding our presence in Africa quite significantly, which is important because Africa is a continent where we haven't traditionally had as much coverage. So that's a product of not having as many staff, as much of a contributor network there. And so we're looking to, you know, address that gap and really scale coverage across the continent. So that's one big exciting initiative. Going to be launching a new website this year. We're going to also be launching a wire service, short form news, and then we're going to be launching a data studio to to support more data journalism. So those are just a few of the major new initiatives that we'll be launching in the next 3 to 4 months. So we have we're keeping busy over here.
We have been speaking with the founder and CEO of Mauga Bay, Rhett Butler. You can find links to all the science and news we just talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. You can get real news about real life on our planet from maugabay.com. I do. Rhett, thank you for your long years of activism and spending time with us today.
Well, thank you so much. It was really an honor to be on your show.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.